The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Sitting down with us today is Nasir Memon, a Brooklyn-based computer scientist and NYU professor. He's the founder of numerous programs, initiatives, and even companies, and was one of the first people to implement a cybersecurity studies program into a college curriculum. Memon started learning computer science without computers. During his first courses as an undergraduate, they wrote programs in machine language and assembler on pen and paper and handed them in. That was at the Birla Institute of Technology and Science in Palani, India. He went on to get a master's and a PhD in computer science from the University of Nebraska. Now a longtime professor in the NYU Tandon School of Engineering, Memon has published over 250 articles, won awards from places like the National Science Foundation, co-founded two startups based on his research, created a conference on cybersecurity awareness, and is the founding director of the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Security and Privacy at NYU. An example of his research is INFER, a network-based infection detection system that Memon developed to find compromised host computers within large networks. With student help, he commercialized the program to be called VIVIC and had the U.S. Army Research Laboratory as the program's first client. Nasir, thanks so much for taking the time.
Sure, my pleasure.
So you seem to have known fairly early on in your career that cybersecurity and security issues were going to be a big issue. Of course, that's become especially timely these days. When did you first start to get the sense that that was an area that you wanted to focus on?
Well, I don't know if I saw it all coming. I didn't actually. I didn't know it was going to be such a big issue, to be honest. But it was fun. And we in academia, we derive our fun to some extent from students. And security turned out to be a subject that I taught where students engaged very eagerly and easily. Sometimes when you're teaching a theory of computer science course, it's hard to sort of get students excited about it. With computer security, that was not the case. They just took to it like fish to water, at least some of them. And the other aspect of it was they just didn't want to listen to lectures, and I felt that was not the right way to learn about this. But they wanted to actually do things, build things, break things, and so a very hands-on experience.
Do you think that's sort of like the legacy of the hacker ethic in computer science?
Precisely. A hacker is someone who is very curious by nature. And loves to sort of just dig his or her hands into something and find a little button point some way that sort of brings the whole thing down, right? I remember talking to a high school student, and this was in the Cybersecurity Awareness Week that we organize yearly. We've been doing that for 15 years. And one of the events is a high school forensics challenge. And in the second year, we sort of gave them pretty sort of challenging problems. And they, to our surprise, they did very well at it in the finals. And one of the judges who was in the FBI forensics lab, he kind of told me that it would take my investigator a lot more time to do this. Hmm. And so I sort of called the student and I asked him, like, where did you learn these things? And because they don't teach you this in school. And he had that twinkle in his eye, and he just said, I just learned it on my own. I enjoy doing it. It's just fun. So that, I think, yeah, that's where many of these people whom we call hackers today, they come from.
In the security business, it seems like, you know, over the years, there's kind of a pendulum that goes back and forth, right? Between, you know, there's people whose job it is to defend systems.
Sure.
And then there's people whose, you know, quote, job it is, or whose,
sure,
avocation or,
sure,
income comes from attacking systems. And it kind of goes back and forth. It feels today, maybe to an outside observer, like the bad guys are winning a lot more. Do you feel that that's true?
Well, true. It's very true. One of my very respected peers, a person called Dan Geer, who is the chief scientist at InQtel, which is a venture funding for the intelligence agencies. He made this famous quote, he made this famous statement that if security was a soccer game, it would be halftime and the score would be 2,000 to 1,800, something like that. Everybody's scoring goals all the time. It's just offense winning all the time. That's true. And there are many reasons for it. One of them is that defense is hard because as the defender, I have to anticipate every possible move that the attacker could make. Whereas as an attacker, I just have to find one vulnerability and I'm in like the weakest link. So by nature, that makes the problem a bit hard. And we have to sort of think about it differently. We still don't know, in my opinion, how to build secure systems. And we don't even know how to teach people to build secure systems. We are learning our way through this.
There's a point of view or a school of thought that would sort of say that, you know, people would be afraid to have their personal information or sensitive information exist really anywhere on any accessible machine and anywhere in the world, with this idea that it's just not safe. You know, people who would seem almost like Luddites, you know, they'd maybe be opposed to electronic medical records or opposed to, you know, cloud services in some ways. That seemed like sort of a paranoid point of view a few years ago. But is it, you know, some people might argue now that it's almost impossible, that you should just assume that the probability is one, that any piece of personal information will eventually become exposed if it exists somewhere. Do you think that's true, or is that sort of still a little paranoid?
Yeah, that's true, because this ephemeral nature of information is gone, right? Just this conversation we're having here today is now recorded, and then it exists as bits, and it'll exist like that for a long time. So that is indeed true, that one cannot assume that data that was captured and digitized and stored somewhere will remain secure forever. So what does that mean? A couple of things perhaps that are implied. One is that if there is everything is sort of open, then the chance of a specific piece of information being misused sort of comes down. I mean, I sometimes tell my friends that don't worry about your credit card number. The bad guys already have it.
It's like the opposite of security by obscurity. It's like security by oversaturation.
By oversaturation, the fog of war or whatever they call it, right? But that's sort of perhaps trivializing it. There's certain things that are so important that we can't make that assumption. And there is some thinking that's sort of taking shape today, which says that if something is very important, let's not digitize it, mm-hmm. right? Let's sacrifice the efficiencies. Why do we digitize things? Because it gives us very efficiencies for disseminating it and modifying it and sort of using it and transmitting it, etc., very cheaply and conveniently, whereas analog signal is not the same thing, is not easy to do. But if some things are very important, like a nuclear power plant or something of that sort, why are we worried? Why are we trying to bring digital technology in there? Let's mm-hmm. keep it analog. This thought is taking ground in some circles today. I don't know how much it'll catch on. But yes, anything digital is not ephemeral anymore.
Right. And a lot of the problems, too, they come from, it's sort of the intersection of a couple things, right? Big data being another one. I mean, there's that famous quote, like, quantity has a quality all its own. You know, once you have enough data, you know, you can, there's, you know, what you call like an emergent property of that data is that you can start to reconstruct things. You know, a classic example would be, you know, once you've collected license plate data of people like at intersections all over the country, mm-hmm. you can figure out who they're having affairs with mm-hmm. or, you know, things like those Uber, some of that anonymized Uber data, a lot of anonymized data sets turn out not to be anonymous.
Right.
The combination of that with lack security,
right,
sort of leads to like this sort of panopticon, right? Is that a thing that's happening?
So those things are all very true. You potentially can, information can leak, but personally, I don't worry about it, right? In the sense that One is in security, one has to think about the threat model. One can always think about possibilities. And if you think about it, we live with insecurities in a physical world as well. Our bodies themselves are so insecure. I mean, you can say, hey, somebody can come and poke a knife into it. And so it's not been designed securely. But there is a notion of trust and a notion of we have other systems in place that lead to such incidents not happening, right? So we have norms in society. We have institutions that, like the justice system, for example. We have even technology to some extent that can help in the prevention of these things, and it's a combination of all that sort of prevents someone from finding out about affairs based on looking at license plates at intersections, right? In principle, yes. Right, but then the time and effort to do that is substantial, right? And in my case, so one could be in the sense, unless somebody's coming after it with the intent of getting that information, it's hard to get it, and one shouldn't it's not something I would that would keep me awake at night. Mm-hmm. So yes, the threat is there, but the likelihood is small. The risk is small. So if you think of it from a risk point of view, in principle, the risk is epsilon. It is non-zero. It is there, but it's small enough that we don't have to worry about it. We should be focusing more on a critical infrastructure. We should be focusing more on the big things.
What should we be worried about in security?
Our critical infrastructure, right? The power grid, the nuclear power plants, or the financial sector, the electronic voting system. And now what worries me is the notion of truth itself is being attacked. What is, with this whole business of fake news, mm-hmm. given a news report with a picture, very, very convincing looking. One looks at it and it's like spreading around social media. Is it true? It's very hard to say that anymore, mm-hmm. right? So the notion of truth is being attacked. The integrity of information is being attacked, and I think we need, those are the big problems, the big challenges that we should be focusing on.
Another recent irony is sort of the word crypto, which you've been familiar with your whole career,
sure.
Suddenly doesn't mean keeping secrets anymore. You know, now it's a slang term for blockchain technology. And of course, there's a crossover between the two, and cryptocurrencies.
Sure.
There's a crossover between those, the worlds of security and cryptography.
Sure.
And this sort of new blockchain phenomenon. Are you a part of this thing at all? It's very current in the news. Is that something that you participate in?
To some extent, I have a project that deals with blockchains that has been funded by the National Science Foundation. Blockchains do use crypto, but there's no deep cryptography concepts that are involved in it. It's reasonably straightforward crypto concepts that we've known for some time. What blockchains do actually might give us is the notion of, it might help us protect the notion of integrity, right? Crypto, classically, we thought of as something that gives us confidentiality, that allows us to encrypt a message, and as long as the key used is kept secret, then the message remains encrypted, right? Or remains secure, confidential. Blockchains, on the other hand, focus more on integrity, that some content has not been modified, that, right? And you use crypto to do that. You mm-hmm. use some simple cryptographic techniques to do that. And earlier on, when I talked about the notion of integrity is under attack, perhaps blockchains may be one way of giving us integrity back, at least in some aspects. So for example, one of the projects we're doing is looking at evidence, media evidence, like in terms of pictures and videos. So we all are walking around with a high-resolution camera in our pocket 24/7. I tell people that I might leave my wife at home, but I don't leave my phone. I always carry it with me, right? And so I may then witness something which I can capture very quickly, right? And without this proliferation of smartphones, we wouldn't have perhaps seen some of the incidents that led to the Black Lives Matter movement, right? It was smartphones that captured those events.
Right. What changed wasn't the police or the culture. It was the fact that everybody had a camera in their pocket, right, that was connected to the internet.
Right. And now we saw it for the first time that, man, these things are happening and this is not right. But then the integrity of that scene could be questioned, perhaps not in our society here in the U.S., but in some other countries where these trust relationships are not there. The law enforcement might say, no, that's a fake picture. Or someone might even feel threatened to reveal that picture because they might feel that the law enforcement would not take it kindly. And so you want to be able to demonstrate that something happened, the integrity of it, that this is a real picture. It was taken at this point in time, in this point in place. And at the same time, do it without revealing your identity. And blockchains can come in useful there, right? So blockchains are useful for preserving integrity, and they're being adopted more and more. I see not just cryptocurrency, but just broadly for
the concept
integrity.
Itself.
Yeah,
sure. Tell us a little bit about how you became an academic. You've had a long journey, both career wise, geographically. How's that gone differently than you thought it would when you started out?
So I never thought I would be a professor. In fact, if some of my professors find out that I was one, they'll probably have a heart attack. I was a very, very bad student in my undergrad. And in high school, there were two things I thought I could become, or in middle school or something like that. One, a high school teacher. And the other psychologist, because I was fascinated by why people behave the way they do, and I didn't like my teachers, high school teachers. In India, we had corporal punishment at that time, and I used to get beaten up every day. And I thought I can do that better, right? I could be a better teacher than I. So that perhaps was there at the back of my mind. And I had a little foray in the business world in India before I came here. And I guess what made me look in the direction of teaching or becoming a professor was inspiration I had from my own professors in Nebraska. I mean, they were just phenomenal. And what I learned from them. And then I realized it's a way of life. And it's not a high school teacher. I believe being a high school teacher is a much more difficult job. Mm-hmm. If I was the dictator of the world, I would make the high school teachers the most highly paid profession in the world because they are so critical. But as college professors, perhaps we do get an opportunity to shape young minds, but perhaps it's a bit late, but we do try. So seeing how, I was inspired by my professors, and I thought, and that's what led me to do this.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you've created here at NYU?
So people credit me with starting the cybersecurity program, for example, and starting this whole event called Seesaw and the master's program, and now some of the online programs and the bridge program. I guess saying I have created is perhaps too strong a word. It's always a group of people who get together, do these things, and but I've played a role in making some of these things come to fruition.
What are some of the differences between, starting new projects or creating new initiatives in the academic world versus, starting something that's intended to be a for-profit or high growth sort of, company?
So I did try my hand at starting two companies, right? And in the beginning, they are similar to what we do in academia. There is a high burst of creativity. There is an intense amount of sort of energy and excitement that we're doing new things and lots of ideas on the table. But a business soon transitions into operations and selling. A business is about selling. I learned that too late. it's about marketing. And so then it's a marketing and operations sort of become the dominant activity. Whereas in academia, we have the comfort of being creative, inventing something, and then handing it over to someone, maybe moving on and doing something else. And sometimes what we do may be useful, sometimes it may not be. Just it's an intellectual curiosity or something of that sort. So in the beginning, I think there's a lot in common. But as a business evolves, it becomes a very different animal.
Tell us a little bit, what were you thinking in you were working on a digital forensics project that ended up becoming a company. What were some of the applications for that and that you saw when you started that?
So actually the problem was suggested to me by an investigator in the Department of Defense Digital Forensics Lab. So I had started working in security, and one of the things I realized very quickly is that security is kind of tough and it's a losing battle. We come up with techniques and then the bad guys circumvent them, right? Whereas forensics has more lasting value because I develop a technique to extract evidence.
Right? You're working on reconstructing digital photography, is that right?
That's right. So evidence of pictures from cameras and things of that sort. So I worked in network forensics and media forensics and things of that sort. But it looked like to me that if I work in forensics, whatever I do would have immediate value. Because law enforcement really needed techniques to analyze evidence which was present in digital form, and they would immediately use it. So I saw that immediate applicability of it, and that started making me look at it. And I was attending a conference where a digital forensics investigator told me about this problem. He said, you know what, when you sort of, we go capture a device and there's evidence on it in terms of pictures, but it's been deleted and we are not able to extract a good part of it because it's what we call fragmented. It's not deleted and sitting in one contiguous chunk, but it's scattered across the device. And we know it's there, but we can't get it back. And I used to actually, before I worked on security, I used to work on data compression. I even played a role in helping create some of the part of the JPEG standard, which we use all the time. So I used to attend that committee and things like that. So I knew images very well. And I said, I think I can do this. And so I came back home to school, that is, and called my students and said, I think we can solve this problem. And, you know, they're bright young kids. Quickly, we came up with solutions and we published a paper. And I thought I was done, right, that somebody will take it and use it. But the students said, why don't we build the tool? Why don't we create the tool? Because clearly law enforcement needs it. They are the ones who asked you, told you about the problem. And so that's what sort of started it.
Interesting. What about Infer, which was a tool for detecting intrusions? Is that right?
Right.
How does that work?
So that was way ahead of its time. That was the problem with Infer. So Infer, what we said is that at that time, 10 years back, that a lot of the security tools we have today are focusing on the doors and the windows, trying to sort of block them and trying to see everything that's going in and out and trying to find bad things coming in, right?
Virtually speaking, you're talking about computer networks now.
Yeah, that's what computer networks do. But we said, you know what? The bad guys are already in. And if you are, the analogy I used to give is if you were asked to watch this room with a bunch of people in it and watch each one of them and see if anyone is infected, you wouldn't be looking at the microbes going in and out of the window. you would be watching them very carefully. You would be watching their behavior very carefully. Mm-hmm. Are they showing symptoms? Right? Are they coughing? Are they sneezing? Do they have a runny nose, etc.? And so we started that way of thinking about network monitoring and what we call, they used to call intrusion detection. And so we sort of created a system that would be watching all the hosts inside a network very carefully and saying, and then coming up with a list saying, these 10, if you're worried about the security of your network, look at these 10 because they are behaving a bit strangely.
Got it.
At that time, people were not ready for it because they didn't have security analysts, and their whole, the way the workflow was more about patching systems, mm-hmm. and that's about it. And when we say there's a problem with that machine, the question was, what's the problem? And our answer was, we don't know what's the problem. But there is a problem because look at the behavior. It's doing strange things.
It's like a thermometer or like a checking someone's pulse.
Right, right. And
you still need a doctor.
Right. And they were not enough doctors.
Right.
Right. Even today, there are not enough doctors, but there are many more today. Every company now has a security team and security analysts and SOCs and things like that. And 10 years back, that was not the case.
Got it. You've also been, you've been a major advocate for online learning and online classes at NYU. Why did you think that was important? Why is that something that you value?
So it is only recently that I started sort of thinking about online learning. And it started when I looked at a program called the Bridge Program that we had created, and I can talk about that more. But the content that we created for the Bridge Program made me understand a few things. One is, and these are known things, it was just I discovered, I had to go through my own path to realize things that people already know, kind of, right? One is that our current educational system is more fashioned after the Industrial Revolution, the assembly line model, right? You have everybody coming in lockstep. They take a course, which is 4 months, and their lecture is 2 hours. And a student goes through from station to station, course to course, and you're stamping them with a grade, and they move on. And they come out at the other end as a finished product, right? Mm-hmm. So that served well to scale education in the 19th century or early 20th century, because that using that model, one could produce a larger number of graduates, right? But today, with technology, that suddenly is really not the most efficient way of doing things. When you have a lecture that takes about 2 hours for you to explain, a student may need, one particular student may be able to grasp what is needed to be understood in half an hour. Another might take 6 hours. In a classroom-like setting, that's not possible to do, right? But once you digitize the lecture, the student can traverse it in any order and with more flexibility in terms of time, right? The second is the way we do learning is that when you're absorbing a new concept, we first hold that temporarily in our brain in the sort of short-term memory. And then we have to get it into long-term memory because that's what learning is. Mm-hmm. And in order for that transition to happen, you have to engage in some activity with it. You have to repeat it. You have to sort of do something that is able to take it to long-term memory. And that's called active learning, and it's been around for decades now. It's hard to do active learning in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But with technology, once you've digitized content, it's much easier to do. You break up learning into chunks of sort of 10 minutes or so and then have assessments after it. The other thing is the notion called mastery learning, in the sense that you don't move on to a concept before learning the prerequisite concept. So for example, in my undergrad, I told you I was a very bad student. I got a D in my Calculus 1 class. They moved me on to Calculus 2. I had no hope in Calculus 2. Mm-hmm. I was dead right at the beginning, right at the start line. And of course, I got a D in that as well. But mastery learning says that unless you understand a concept, you don't move on to the next one, even within a class, right? And it's hard to do in a classroom. I've tried to do that in a physical classroom, but again, using technology online, you can sort of, different students can progress through material at different speed, ensuring that they've mastered. One student can finish a course in 2 months, another can take 6 months. We can have this flexibility. And finally, when you teach in the physical world, at least for me, I'm not the best of teachers. When I'm preparing for the class, I ask myself, what will I teach? What will I say? What is the dance that I will dance, right? How will I make it interesting? That's well and good. But when we design online content, the first thing we ask is, what is it that the student will learn? And how will I assess the fact that they will learn? So it's just turned around. The focus is not on me and what I will say, but on the student. And what is it that the student will learn? And how will I assess that? And how will then the student navigate through the material, getting the learning outcomes that I want the student to achieve, right? So it becomes very learning outcomes focused. Whereas in the physical world, we have more sort of, we have this model that we go lecture for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks and then give a quiz and exam, and that's how we assess learning. And that's too late, right? It has to be done continually. And again, online learning, or technology, broadly speaking, allows you to do that. So I think technology will allow us to really radically change how to deliver quality experiences. And then finally, using technology, one can lower the cost as well. There's no reason why a master's degree should cost $50,000, right? And using technology, the universities have stepped forward now, and they are demonstrating the fact that one can deliver high-quality learning experiences at a cheaper price.
Speaking of the physical world, do you think that people are becoming aware that there's a genuine technology academic hub happening here in downtown Brooklyn? There's Palo Alto, there's Route 128, sort of these technology hubs. And then there's always been like these micro sort of areas, or what you guys call second tier stuff, like Austin, the area around CMU or Champaign, Illinois, that are like focused on one institution, say. But do you think Brooklyn has the potential? I mean, Brooklyn is such a culturally important place now. Do you think it has the potential to be equal to something like, Silicon Valley, as it grows and becomes a technology hub?
I think so, and I hope so, because it has, it's not there yet, clearly. But just personally, coming to Brooklyn every day for 18 years, I've seen the transformation, right? And we are at a point where things are simply, I mean, every 6 months, it's very different from what it was 6 months back, right? And so things are moving at a fantastic pace, and there is an energy and there is excitement and new companies coming here and new schools and Tandon itself is growing at a phenomenal pace. That I'm very optimistic that Brooklyn in a few years will be known as one of the technology hubs in the country, as one of the leading technology hubs in the country.
So. Great. What's next for you personally?
Online. I still have a lot to do there. I've just started. I want to create quality learning experience that are affordable and that are open to all. And by open to all, I mean we sort of, in academia, we have these gateways that we don't let people in unless they have a specific qualification. Either a particular degree or a particular GPA or things of that sort. And I think, and that's how they become exclusive, and that's how they're known as being selective. And I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Our job is to take whatever input we get and produce the best output. We should be measured by our output, not by our input. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to take good input, right? You just raise the price and make it exclusive and selective. And then the hard part is taking input and creating whatever input you get and creating really great output. And one of the problems we're looking at, for example, which I'm very passionate about, is this issue of the millennials not participating in the technology boom that is going on today. There is a McKinsey study that shows that 51% of the millennials are either underemployed or unemployed. And part of the reason is that at the end of high school, either they did not have the opportunity to choose a discipline that was related to technology, or they were attracted to something else, and for good reason. But that same discipline is not providing them enough opportunity now to do justice to their talent, right? Mm-hmm. The number of people who graduate with a degree in as a park ranger is the same as the number of people who graduate with a computer science degree. Hmm. Clearly, we need many more computer scientists, right? Being a park ranger is a great job. I would love to do it, and nothing against it. But it's just the numbers. Mm-hmm. Double the number of psychology majors we produce as compared to computer science majors, right? Double. And so what happens is that once these students, they finish their undergrad, they find themselves locked out of a technology career. If they want to now switch, we look at them and say, hey, you don't have a technology degree. Mm-hmm. You did anthropology. How can you do computer science now? You have a GPA of 2.2. I myself did chemical engineering and I hated it. And that's why I had 2.2. But that doesn't mean I was not capable of doing better. I was just trapped in something that I did not like. And we don't provide an avenue or a path to these students to demonstrate themselves, to show their talent. And in the Bridge program, the one we've created, we say, we don't care where you're coming from, what degree, hopefully what GPA as well, although that's not the case right now. Just come on in and we'll have an intense sort of a boot camp-like experience for 4 months, only for $1,500 because you're already in debt, you don't have a job. We want to make it as easy as possible for you. And if you do well, we will admit you into a master's program. We will try our best to get you scholarships to the extent that we can and give you a path to a career in technology. And it's not just about technology, but it's about sort of the way higher education functions. I think it doesn't sort of the way it's the selectivity and exclusivity, et cetera, are the metrics by which the higher education institutions are measured. And I think that needs to go away. Mm-hmm. So those are the things I'll be trying to work on in the next few years. So.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. No problem. Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
You've been listening to From Day One, How Brooklyn Entrepreneurs Got Their Start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, to learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigman. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulance. Thanks for listening.